We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers, remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.
I'm Ronnie Allen, and today it's my pleasure to introduce one of my favorite rock and roll singers, who, after about 50 years in the business, is still knocking himself out, entertaining his devoted fans, and getting standing ovations, and also singing his hits in their original keys. Ladies and gentlemen, I am proud to present right now Mr. Luigi Alfredo Giovanni Sacco. He's much better known as Lou Christie. Now, did I pronounce that correctly, Lou?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's easier to
very
say,
well.
It's easier to say Lou Christie.
Be around some Italians.
It is a pleasure to be talking to you. Ladies and gentlemen, I have to just tell you a few things about this guy that you probably don't know, but I know they're true because they're on your official website. Highlights from your performing career include appearances on Dick Clark's Caravan of Stars, sharing 72 consecutive one-nighters with Diana Ross and the Supremes, and a command performance for Queen Elizabeth and the Royal Family. You shared the stage with many of the great rock and roll artists, including the Rolling Stones, The Who, Neil Diamond, Roy Orbison, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, and a whole slew of others. And incidentally, John Lennon reportedly said, Lou Christie was one of my influences, and Madonna thanked you, Lou Christie, in the liner notes of her 10 million selling Immaculate Collection LP.
Gosh, so that's all on the website? My website?
Yeah, it has to be true then, right?
Well, it is, but I didn't even know all that was on the website.
See, you're learning all about Lou Christie yourself at this point.
Always learning about Lou Christie.
Before we get to all of your hits, and we're going to play every one of your biggest hits today, mm-hmm. I have to ask you one question. I saw you in Easton, Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
And we got several standing ovations. This was about 3 years ago. Mitch Ryder was there and Andy Kim and a few other acts. I remember at the time that either you told me or one of your associates told me, it might have been Linda or Kathy, that you still sing everything in the same key that you originally recorded. Is that still true 3 years later?
Yes, it is.
That is amazing.
Yeah, I do. I don't know if my concentration is so much on, you know, doing it right or doing it as close as I can to, you know, what it was when I recorded it. It's great to sing in the keys that I recorded them in. And I've been lucky. I don't know, I haven't abused maybe my throat or, you know, I was never a large drinker. I drink wine and that. And I don't run around shouting and I don't like to go out to clubs and things like that. So I never really sort of burned my throat out by smoking a lot and all that.
And some of your songs are not the easiest songs in the world to sing because most of your hit records go from one voice, which people would call your normal voice,
yeah,
to your falsetto voice.
it's like almost a vocal gymnastics, you know, that I do with my voice.
It began in Glen Willard, Pennsylvania, which is where you were born.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a suburb of Pittsburgh?
It's a suburb of nothing. Nowhere.
Nowhere.
It was about 35 miles outside of Pittsburgh, and it was on the Ohio River. The Monongahela and the Allegheny River form Pittsburgh. That's where the Ohio River starts. And it was about 35 miles down the river from Pittsburgh. It was just a little town alongside the river, but we lived up on the hill on Spring Run Road, so we weren't even part of a town. It was just sort of the suburb of Glen Willard. My dad built a house there before I was born, and I was born in the house, and it's still there. And we had like about 109 acres of sort of crab apple trees, and we had a little farm there and had all the kind of animals and things like that.
By the way, before I go any further, I want to say that Denise and Bernadette, and you know Denise and Bernadette very well.
Oh, do I know Denise and Bernadette?
We're going to be talking a lot about Denise Ferry and Bernadette Carroll, and also Peggy Santillia when we talk about the MGM recordings. But in the meantime, long before lightning struck, you recorded some records in New York and Pittsburgh, and one of the recordings was called The Jury. Your group was called Luigi, L-U-G-E-E, and the Lions.
Well, Luigi and the Lions, well, one of them was my sister. They were the people that I sort of pressured into, like, come on, you got to sing background for me. Come on, let's go. You know, we're starting a group. I'm forever starting another group, you know. Music was my main thing, and I just had to figure out how to get a hit record. And the first record, well, we did a couple of backgrounds. The record we did background was Marcy Jo's record called Ronnie Come Back.
I love Ronnie, because my name is Ronnie, and I love Marcy Jo's record.
You're aware of it, then?
I'm totally aware of it.
Me and my sister, me, Kay, and Bill, we sang background for that. That's Ronnie Come Back. And that was when I jumped up into falsetto, you know. So I told the producer, I said, listen, we have a new group. We sound like three mice. I said, it's our own sound. No one has it. And he said, well, you know, here's the song I'm going to cut in a couple weeks. See if you can do some background. Well, they love the sound.
We're going to hear it right now.
Oh, great.
I happen to have the record, and it's on the Robbie label. This is Marcy Jo, backed up with several people, including Luke Christie. Of course, you weren't Luke Christie then. And this is Ronnie. Label. By the way, Lou, you mentioned your sister, but you haven't mentioned what her name is.
Amy.
Amy.
Yeah, Amy.
Once in love with Amy.
She was about 18 months older than me, and I was forever dragging her into this business and saying, come on, you got to help me. And she really didn't want to have anything to do with it. But, you know, everyone in our family sang, so I was so used to, like, you know, doing the dishes and whatever we had to do. After school, but we always sang, sang together. And usually I sang the lead because I didn't really know how to harmonize then. And she was the one that was harmonizing. But then all of a sudden when I had to step up into the, you know, cutting my first record and things like that, I also had to, I wanted to jump into the background because I thought to create that sound, that sort of,
right.
You know, and when we did background for Marcy, we all sort of, everyone tried to sound like, Three Little Lou Christies or something.
Oh, my gosh.
That whiny sound
that we used. I never knew. You know, I had heard the record so many times, and I never knew you were on that record.
Sure, and do you remember Since Gary Went in the Navy,
since
the follow-up?
Gary went in the Navy.
That was us, too.
That was about Gary Troxell.
Apparently it was written for him.
Of the Fleetlets.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, I'm sure you had a lot of fun making those records, Lou, but I don't think you made a lot of money from them.
We never got paid for any background things, but they said, well, we're going to let you cut your own record, which became The Jury by Lou Gene and the Lions.
Now, was Marcy Joe on this record?
No.
Okay.
No, it was just us without Marcy.
Marcy ain't on this one, but here's Lou Gene and the Lions. They were all very friendly Lions, of course, and this is called The Jury.
Will the defendant please step forward?
You are the jury, and I'm so guilty of the
things you make an angel out of you. Oh, honey, to make a dream come true.
You are the jury, and I'm so guilty of
Lions. By the way, the flip side of that record is quite interesting. It's called Little Did I Know.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that one?
You know, we didn't even know which was the A side at that point. We just, you know, picked, you know, our two songs that we worked on. But there was something about it. It's funny, my daughter said, Dad, I never heard that song, the, you know, the other side of The Jury, you know, your first record. And she said, I love it.
Wow.
It's been 50-some years, but it she loved the record, and she's pretty hip, and, you know, she likes many of the same records that are out there, you know.
My heart.
Oh.
Fuji and the Lions. And it wasn't too long after that that something came along called the Gypsy Cried. But before the Gypsy Cried came along, you met a very special lady. What was her name?
Well, I had known Twyla before that because...
Twyla Herbert, by the way.
Twyla Herbert, sure. I knew Twyla. We had worked with a group called The Classics, and we cut a record for Star Records, and I wasn't even singing lead, I was singing background. That's where I really learned to do my background stuff. That all sort of led up to being Luigi and the Lions, you know, because life was moving too slow for me, and I was pushing ahead trying to figure out how I was going to get on record. Twyla wrote those songs herself, those two songs, The Jury and Little Did I Know. And I just worked on the falsetto and did all the backgrounds and things like that. So that was one situation. But the first song we wrote together in 15 minutes was The Gypsy Cried. She had so much talent, and we just had this crazy relationship between us. I mean, the whole thing was so bizarre.
Was Twyla actually a gypsy?
Yes, her mother was a Hungarian gypsy.
So you wrote this in 15 minutes. You recorded it and released it on a small label, which was called Cohen C.
Yeah.
Is that the same label that eventually had the Vogues?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So back then it was a lot smaller.
It was Cincy and Cohen, yeah. I think it may have been the first record that came out on CNC.
The hit version of the record, actually, which was the original recording, it was picked up by Roulette Records.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to listen to it right now. Right after I play it, I'm going to talk about your name. Because the billing on this record said, Lou Christie. And this is Lou singing, The Gypsy Cried.
I had some trouble with my baby, so I had my fortune read. I had some trouble with my baby, and this is what the gypsy said. The gypsy cried.
Cried by Lou Christie. Now, how'd you get the name Lou Christie?
Well, I remember walking into the office, and I just wanted to go under the name of just probably Luigi, you know, just one name. Fabian was popular at the time, and then I thought one name could have been interesting. And Italian names were sort of, you know, we had Frankie Avalon, Bobby Raitt, all the Italian guys were sort of like
right.
on their way up and stars then. And I just wanted to go under the name Luigi. Of course, when you're deciding who you are or what's going to happen, you know, I had sort of a list of paper of how many names. It was DiGino, a Lugino, and da, 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 da. I went on and on. But I walked in and they said, oh, no, no, your name's Lou Christie. The record comes out today or something. We should receive. I thought, well, yeah, thanks. Thanks for asking me, since I will be that person. But of course, I had to keep my mouth quiet because I was just a nice little dumb kid from, you know, Spring Run Road, Coriopolis, PA. I was getting my first record out, so I didn't have too much to say about it. It was too late. The record came out, but my dad said, It's a great name because it has the word Christ in it, and it's going to bring you good luck. And being the nice Italian that my father was, I just said, oh, all right, because he tried to say, okay, you know, it's going to bring you good luck. And you know, it really was, because it was the first record, and my name was Lou Christie, and it became a million-selling record.
The Gypsy Cry features your trademark sound of basically singing normally and then going into a falsetto and
right.
then going back to normal and then going back to falsetto. And
right.
Was this something at the very outset that you said to yourself, this is going to be my style on most of my records in the future?
The reason that I did that, I wanted to get my own sound. I didn't want to sound like anyone else. And I thought that we had a crazy relationship, Twyla and I. We had a different kind of sense of humor. I don't know. It was just a way of being original. And I thought, I have to get their attention, because everyone said, oh, if you have, you know, a record, you know, they put the needle on the record, and if it doesn't get them or get their interest in about 15 seconds, you know, they'll just take it off and they'll never play it again. So the disc jockey said, you know, you've got to get their attention. Everyone kept saying, you got to get their, well, that's all I needed to hear. And so Twyla and I, that's when we hit the court, said, I have some trouble with my baby. So it was like, let's catch them right away with that chord and then the falsetto.
Yeah.
And then when I did the and then the harmony on that,
yeah.
It was, I mean, everyone was saying, what the hell is that? You know, what's going on? Who is it? And what is it? And da-da-da.
Wow.
And this got their attention. I mean, it really did. And people were just amazed. They thought I was a black girl at first. Then they thought I was a group for a while. Then they I don't know what the hell they thought. I mean, it really went on and on until my picture showed up and people saw who I was.
Oh, what's better than having one hit record than having two hit records? In fact, even better than that, the follow-up record to The Gypsy Cry, Two Faces Have I, became an even bigger hit. And it got to the top 10.
Yeah.
And what can you tell me about Two Faces Have I? Did Twyla say, let's write a song called Two Faces Have I? Did she start with the ideas most of the time, or did you start with the ideas?
You know, we would sit, drink coffee, and start talking. And our personalities led us into whatever we decided. It was never sort of I started the melody, or I started the talk about it, or we would talk, and then we would just all of a sudden come up with these titles. We always worked from a title, and we really liked titles, you know, because, again, we wanted to be our own person, you know, and so we loved the title, The Gypsy Cry, then Two Faces of I, and they wanted us to change it to, oh, God, Mr. Happy, Mr. Blue, and I thought, why in the world would we want, I mean, there's nothing interesting about that title.
Not at all.
I thought, and then there is a Mr. Blue by the Fleetwoods, why in the hell would we want to change Two Faces Have I, one to laugh, one to cry? Aesthetically, it rolled, it was different, it was unique, and so, you know, that was one of our early fights that they left it alone, and
the rest is history.
It became, Two Faces, my second million-selling record.
But I'm Mr. Blue.
Shut up.
I pretend that I'm happy.
Shut up. Since
I lost you.
Yeah.
Two Faces Have I, another great recording by Lou, of a song written by him and Twyla Herbert.
And Twyla, we were not, like, sophisticated in music or doing arrangements. It was all what was going on in our heads, but we had to transfer that somehow onto this two-track or a four-track machine. You know, the more people we worked with who knew the answers, we would find out they didn't know the answers. You know, after they would take our creativity and just sort of... So we would use all of our creativity.
Who were the backup singers on The Gypsy Cry in Two Faces Have I?
My sister Amy.
Mm-hmm.
Shirley and Kay. Shirley, it was Twyla's daughter, and Kay was Amy and Shirley's friend, so she was sort of a girl next door. It's so interesting because we all got together again last year. They flew into New York, and
wow,
we had a great time here because, you know, there's nothing like Christmas in New York. So they flew in from Arizona and from Los Angeles and from North Carolina, so they all got together, and it was sort of our reunion, and they came to one of the concerts that I was doing. Oh, we had a great, great time, and they're still very good friends. And each year they get together and go somewhere, the three of them together. We're all still friends from the very, very
beginning,
where it all started. So I had my three girls always that had that sound, you know. They knew exactly how to sort of bend and get into that sound. And then, of course, we picked it up with Bernie and Denise and Peggy, too.
Before we strike some lightning... I want to play one record that didn't become a hit. In fact, I'm not even sure it was a single, but a friend of mine requested this. He said you did kind of an answer record to Mr. Bassman by Johnny Cymbal.
Oh, this was a great record.
Mr. Tenorman?
Tenorman, yes. I thought it was a great record. After Two Faces Have I remember I was on tour on the Dick Clark Caravan, and they pulled me off the tour, Morris Levy. They were all very nervous because Twyla and I were writing partners. There was a little trouble with publishing and things like that because we were getting pretty hip about what was going on because they were stealing our publishing, and that meant a lot of money, and they obviously didn't want to pay us because they never got paid for these records after they were million-selling records. They wanted to own the publishing, and they tried to break us up, and that went on and on every couple years. People tried to break the combination of she and I as writers, and they flew me into New York, and so we did three records together with George Goldner, who did a lot of records for Roulette Records.
Sure.
And we recorded Mr. Tenorman, How Many Teardrops, and You and I Have a Right to Cry. And Mr. Tenorman was an answer to Mr. Bassman. I thought it was a great record, but I hated the lyrics. It was embarrassing for me to even sing them because it said, I'm Mr. Tenorman, and don't you know that I got the sound that the kids love best? It was like such an ego. It was embarrassing. My mind doesn't go that way. I'm the best.
Can I play just a little bit of that?
Yeah, it's a great record. It's a great record.
But not to be taken seriously, this is Lou Christie and his answer record to Mr. Bassman called Mr. Tenorman.
They say about him, I couldn't care less. Well, I'm a tenor man, and I don't you forget that I have got the sound that the kids love best. They all come around when we hit the town. They never start screaming till they hear this sound. Now I don't care about a boom, boom, boom. They never start to croon till they hear me croon.
So you didn't write that song?
No, I didn't.
You mentioned that you did How Many Teardrops around that time. It wasn't a huge hit, but it was a chart record, so we're going to play it right now.
How many teardrops must I cry till you believe in me? And how many teardrops must I dry to end this misery? I want to know how many teardrops must I cry.
Wish I knew the reason.
why you've gone and made me blue. You didn't even tell me that you and I were through. It's all a part of a little game that you took up on me, trying to find out just how much you really mean to me. If that's the reason for leaving, there's no reason to explain. 'Cause baby, I really need you like the roses need the rain.
I wanna know how many teardrops must I cry.
Getting back to the subject of backup singers, who were the Tammies, and were you working with them around that time?
Well, the Tammies were my next three girls. Yeah, I was working at them at the time because they were trying to get into show business. They were they lived in a little town called Oil City, and I went and did a show there, and we heard them sing. I rode around in my 59 Cadillac, and they sang all of my songs for me, and I said, oh my God, let me keep going here, and I'm going to find you kids a recording contract. And then Twyla and I started writing for them, and we put my sister Amy in charge of managing them. And they were three girls who were in high school, and they became the new Lou Christie sound on a couple of the records, Colpix album. They were unbelievable.
This was after Roulette, between Roulette and MGM?
Yes.
So we're going to hear guitars and bongos. This was on Colpix?
Yes.
And the Tammies are the backup singers?
Yes.
Oh, come with me.
Guitars and bongos, and the backup group on that one was the Tammies, who happen to be made up of sisters Gretchen and Kathy Owens and their friend Linda Jones. Now, Lou, if you include the Luigi and the Lions single, you had a group of backup singers there, and you had different backup singers on The Gypsy Cried and Two Faces of I, and as we just mentioned, different backup singers on guitars and bongos, and moving further down the line, you had a different group of backup singers on something called Lightning Strikes.
Yes, but the thing of it was to make them sound like it was a consistent thing, and that's why it worked for us. Because when we wrote the song, we wrote the part. We knew what the sound was supposed to be,
mm-hmm.
and we loved the sound of the record. I didn't have three girls that you just hire, you know, who run around and do studio things. We started working with, when I came into New York, when we started working on Lightning, we became a family when we worked with Bernie, Denise, and Peggy, who then did my backgrounds in New York, and we did the whole Lightning Strikes album and a Painter of Hits album with Rhapsody in the Rain and all that.
Yeah.
So they became, I mean, it was literally like they were, you know, our next-door neighbor, our friends, our family. I mean, that's how close they were. God, they had sort of a brilliant musicality about them. And working with me and Twyla and all of us together, we had a ball. We had a lot of fun, a lot of laughs.
Remember how the song Lightning Strikes originated? Was this your idea or Twyla's idea?
We started with the title. We had written, I think, Lightning Strikes probably about four different times because we liked the title.
But it never struck the first three times.
Well, we always, if you know, a lot of times we used to take our own titles. If it didn't make it, if it was a throwaway, we would write it. If I didn't record it, it was sitting on the shelf or something like that. We would use the title again and rewrite everything around it. But we just wrote, I don't know, different parts of it. I remember Twyla was trying to get that part, I can't stop, no, I can't stop myself. You know, we wanted to stick that in the middle of the thing because we started with the hook. We had Lightning Striking Again. So we had that. And then I wrote the part, there's a chapel in the pines, da 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 da. And then we both were, listen to me, baby. But she wanted to stick that I can't stop. And it was like, oh my God, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. We had to get the plane about 7 o'clock back to New York City because we were in Pittsburgh writing it. And so we just had to put it together. And we thought, oh my God, it's too long. We got too many parts to this song. It was a typical production or a typical writing combination between Twyla and I. We usually had so many parts to our songs.
This one took especially long to write because you had so many attempts that didn't quite make it. Now, did you ever think of calling the song Lightning Striking? Because you never sing the words Lightning Strikes.
I know.
It wouldn't sing good. Lightning Strikes. Again?
No. It was Lightning Striking. And we would push again. And we would push certain sounds or certain vowels or words that made it stand out, you know. I swear I don't know, Lightning Strikes, and I don't think I ever said it, do I?
You never say it. You never say Lightning Strikes. But again, I can see the reason, because the disc jockeys would have a tough time. Lightning Striking is a hard title to say. Lightning Strikes is an easier title
to
say.
Yeah.
But singing, it's different. Now, before I play it, I want you to tell the world, because there's been a lot of confusion about this, what were the...
Puppy, I-O!
Is it Puppy or Buppy? I don't even know.
It's Puppy, and
it's
Denise
Puppy.
Insists that it's Buppy, I-O.
Oh,
she may have been singing Buppy, I-O, but it was Puppy, I-O. Every time I see Denise...
You know what Denise told me? She says, before you do this interview, I want to tell you, let Lou tell you that it's Puppy. We know it was Buppy, but Lou thinks it was Puppy. So what you just told me is consistent.
Yes, that's the
all
truth.
Right.
And it's very funny because every time we see it, you know, because we did it.
Yeah, that's what they're going. Puppy-ah-oo or Puppy-ah-oo, either one. Now, before I play the record, I want you to name the three full names of the backup singers on this record, Lightning Strikes. Or maybe I'm going to name them and you tell me if I'm correct. They were Bernadette Carroll, Denise Ferry, and Peggy Santillia. Lou Christie, is that correct?
Is correct.
Okay, world.
And
here's
Susan Christie is not my sister.
And Susan Christie, who loves onions, is not Lou Christie's sister.
She is not my sister. I never met her. And with Peggy, Bernie, and Denise, who did an unbelievable job on that record.
And here it is, ladies and gentlemen, a little drum roll for A number one smash from 1966, which was actually recorded in 1965, but who cares? This is Lou Christie, back with Peggy and Bernadette and Denise, and Lightning Strikes.
Listen to me, baby, you gotta understand.
Hi-ya.
You're old enough to know the makings of a man.
Hi-ya.
Listen to me, baby, it's hard to settle down.
Hi-ya.
Am I asking too much for you to stick around? Every boy wants a girl he can trust to the very end. Baby, that's you, won't you wait? But till then, when I feel it,
taken
over my one-track mind. Believe it or not, you're in my heart all the time. All the girls are saying that you'll end up a fool. For the time being, baby, live by my rules.
When I settle down, I want one baby on my mind.
Forgive and forget,
and I'll make up for all of time.
If she put together fine,
in the pines, waiting for us around the bend.
Picture in your mind,
love forever.
But till then,
if she gives me a sign that she wants to make.
Number one on my birthday, February 19th. It was the week, February 19th, and Billboard and Record World went to the
Cashbox
was number one on my birthday. Isn't that something?
Denise told me after she did the session, she said, Lou, I think this is a number one record.
Yes, everyone. We were so juiced up about it. And the girls were just snap, crackle, and pop in those
records.
You just
said something that reminded me.
I want to play a great record that we recorded on those sessions. Play Trapeze.
I'm going to. But you just mentioned juiced. And that reminds me, you recently did a concert celebrating the music of Charlie Colello. And Juice Newton. Speaking of juiced, Juice was on that concert. And also present were two of the three backup singers, Denise and Bernadette.
Wasn't that fantastic? They were great.
And they did Lightning Strikes on stage with you.
They did.
And by the way, for those trivia buffs out there, the flip side of Lightning Strikes was Crying in the Streets. I wonder, when you did Crying in the Streets, did you have a sore throat after that?
Wow, the poor girls, all that barking.
And the girls. they're the ones that had the sorest throats, I am telling you.
Yeah, and let me tell you, that's very hard to do if you know anything about someone's vocal cords or throat. You know, we did these most bizarre sounds sometimes, and that's where we had a good time doing it.
We're going to move to the follow-up record to Lightning Strikes, and this one was a little bit controversial, and it's called Rhapsody in the Rain, based, incidentally, on Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet.
Twyla and I both love classics. As a matter of fact, she taught classics as a concert pianist and as a teacher of classics. Twyla was twice my age almost. I was 15 and we met. She was 30 some years old.
All right, so she was about 20 years older than you.
Yeah. She was sort of teaching music at the time, and she was an incredible piano player. But she's very funny because she never could play rock and roll.
No.
We just clonk it out, clonk, clonk, clonk.
You know, but you got,
because there was no music to read. There wasn't, you know, 150 pages of Chopin. There was, you know, these crazy chords we were making up and trying. But thank God all that knowledge she had about classical music really helped us, because we never really wanted to keep in four chords like rock and roll. That's why the records were always unique and they were harder to break, because they were taking the audience's ear in other places, you know, new places that rock and roll records weren't used to going, because Rhapsody in the Rain is pretty involved.
The song tells of a teenager's regret over his experience in the backseat of a car during a rainstorm as the windshield wipers made a rhythmic sound of together, together. And that was a little bit much for radio. Many radio stations banned the record after it came out. What we're going to do is play the original version of the song, uncensored. So is this one like rated between PG and R or something? I don't know.
All I know is it was banned.
It was banned. Anyway, it
made me go in and change the lyrics.
Yeah, same backup singers backing up Lou Christie on this one. The follow-up to Lightning Strikes, Rhapsody in the Rain. Bernadette and Peggy were summoned by you, and you said, we got to go back in the studio because some radio stations aren't playing it, so we're going to do a tamer version of the song.
The thing about it is we only had to punch in a few lines. There was a different mix on it, but really from the very first recording, they're still doing Rhapsody in the Rain, Rhapsody in the Rain.
Right.
So we just did some of the new lines and things like that, and we punched them in.
Lay for me. How lovely, Rhapsody. us on our first date. We fell in love in the rain.
Love in the rain, as opposed to making out.
We were making out in the rain. That's where it should have been. It should have stayed that way.
Denise told me the girls weren't thrilled about having to redo it because they thought they had a masterpiece and it was like you were trying to repaint the Mona Lisa.
Thank you.
This is Ronnie Allen, so thrilled to be talking to one of my favorite rock and roll singers of all time, Lou Christie. And I hope someday, Lou, that they do the right thing and they put you in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But that's another issue. That's my own personal opinion. I think you believe.
Don't get me started about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I have no intention of getting into it because there are many, many other people who should be in there way before I go in. And one of them I want to say right now, Neil Sedaka. Why in the heck isn't that man in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
Why isn't Paul Anka in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
And you could make
they are so screwed up in that thing. I would love for them to tell me what the criteria is for getting in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame so I could tell Paul and Neil.
Well, this
makes me furious.
I want to mention a couple of others. Chubby Checker, of course.
Yes!
And Connie Francis as well, considering what she did.
I can't even go there. It's
moving right along now. Trapeze. Oh,
yes.
This is the Chungking song. Now, Denise told me that what they were singing in the background, they weren't singing Buffy or Puppy Au. They were singing Chungking.
That's right.
In Trapeze. This was featured in the Ethan Hawke film Before Sunrise, and I understand that this song was played in its entirety.
Unbelievable. I had no idea that it was even in there. I was watching the film and I thought, oh my God, there's trapeze all the way through.
I gotta live fast and you've got what I need. I want you, baby. Lovin's like a trapeze. We had a swinger swing, and then a tender swing.
Now you're falling, falling, falling.
I told you, hold on tight. It was just too late.
Now you're calling, calling, calling. Trapeze, mama, baby, you'll never, never fly with me. Trapeze, mama, baby, you'll never, never fly with me.
In a million, I thought you would be. You live but not enough to fly with me. You're on the ground and you're crying. Goodbye, baby, cause I gotta keep on flying.
Was the flip side of Rhapsody in the Rain.
Yes.
Yes, it was.
Yes, that could have been two-sided.
It could have been two A sides, but back in the mid-60s, there were not that many two-sided hits.
No, there weren't. Once you cut these records, you know, they get out of your hands. And, you know, you always think, well, the record company knows what they're doing, and the guy who's the president of the company knows what he's doing, and the producer of this one, and you think they know what they're doing, but you know what? They don't. And this is the biggest probably lesson that was always, I think, thwarted at me as trying to, you know, of thinking that these people know what they're doing. And I went through most of my career always thinking that, you know, because, I mean, people, you know, you work with successful people and you think, well, they have the answers, but they really don't, because it's coming from you. The creator is me and Twyla. The biggest problem always for me was fighting the people behind the desk or the people who thought they had the answers and thought they knew. Those two records never should have been linked together. Trapeze was a hit by itself, and so was Rhapsody in the Rain.
I think Trapsody. Trapsody, I just said Trapsody.
Exactly, it was a Trapsody.
Trapsody in the Rain. These definitely should have been separate records.
Absolutely, we would have got 2 million sellings out of that session.
When you wrote these songs, you had in your mind what you thought the vocal arrangements should sound like. Did the girls actually help you design some of them?
They got right into it with us, and it became like, you know, try this, and then, you know, when they would try that, would change it a little bit, and, you know, oh, no, they added their own crazy taste, too, and I love them, and they are so much in my life, and they've added so much to my life of having them as friends, and their talent just topped it off.
Before we move on to I'm Gonna Make You Mine, any last thoughts about Twyla Herbert? Twyla passed away a couple of years ago?
Yes.
Any final thoughts about Twyla?
Oh, I mean, gosh. She was just, you know, I don't even know if I can put any of it into words, to be quite honest. And I think if you knew Twyla or saw how we worked, all I can say is she was the most unique person that, I guess, exposed me to life, to took me on a trip without dropping acid. She was probably the most talented, really unique person I've ever met in my life.
That's
personality-wise, I can go on. There's a whole book there, and I don't even know if I'd get into writing it.
You must have written hundreds of songs with
her. Oh, God. I have boxes full of old tapes and that we, you know, things that we wrote and us, you know, banging at the piano throughout the years, because we started in, pretty much 1960 or 1961, all the way, you know, I mean, 20-some years, 25 years we were.
Are we going to hear any of those buried treasures that have not...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Some of the best songs no one has ever heard. I just have loads of memories and loads of tapes.
Going to talk about a song that became your last top 10 record. It came out in 1969, and it's called I'm Gonna Make You Mine. This one was written by a gentleman named Tony Romeo, who had two other big hits that he wrote, a number one hit by the Partridge Family called I Think I Love You, and also he wrote Indian Lake by the Cowsills. But he wrote also for you, I'm Gonna Make You Mine. Now here's the big mystery. Everybody wants to know this. Who were the three backup singers on I'm Gonna Make You Mine?
Well, let me see. One was Linda Scott.
I've told every little star.
Yes. Ellie Greenwich was the other, and I'm trying to think if...
Ellie told me, before she passed away, she said that she wasn't sure who the third one was, but it might have been Mikey Harris.
I think it may have been Mikey Harris, or...
We're not going to solve the mystery today. I actually talked to one of the producers, Mr. Duckman.
Yeah.
And he couldn't remember who the third girl was. But I'll tell you one thing. The song was a great song. Did you like it as the first time you heard the song?
Well, I did, and I didn't even know Tony at the time. Tony and I became very close friends until his passing.
Until he passed away. He passed away at a young age.
I was looking for a song at that time. I was either starting to spend more time in Europe, and I moved, you know, in England and things like that. So Neil Bogart, he had a bunch of records. He said, go home and take a listen to these, see if you like any of them. And I heard I'm Gonna Make You Mine. I said, oh, this is great, you know.
Fabulous
hit record. We cut the record, and Neil just got behind it and said, we're going to make this thing a hit. And it just started taking off and became another million-seller for me.
Yeah, million-seller and a top-ten record. Lou Christie and I'm Gonna Make You Mine.
Every trick in the book, with every step that you take, everywhere that you look, just look, and you'll find, I'll try to get to your soul, I'll try to get to your mind, I'm gonna make you mine, I know I'll never give up, I'm at the end of my rope, from the morning till supper time, and you'll find, I'll be waiting in line, I'll be waiting in line, I'm gonna make you.
Make you mine.
There's a couple of YouTube videos out there, but the backup singers that you see on those videos were not the ones on the record.
No.
Well, Lou, this has just been such a joy for me to walk down memory lane with you. You have an amazing career, and it is continuing. You are still a tireless performer. You do a lot of performances. You're probably not doing as many as you once did, but you're still pretty active, right?
Oh, gosh. I am, as a matter of fact. About every weekend, I'm still on the road and running around the country and doing shows. This weekend, I'm in Syracuse, I think, New York. I just played the Beacon Theater in New York a couple weeks ago. Right. And I'm at Westbury. I'm still out there doing it, and it's even more fun today than it was when I sort of first started, because I sort of like more in control of who I am and what my show
right.
is, and I'm enjoying it. And to walk out on the stage and see all these people turn 17 right before my eyes, and then it's my turn to turn 17, I get to do it. It's the soundtrack to their lives, you know.
Lou, I cannot thank you enough, and as far as I'm concerned, I could not think of a better closing record than this one, Beyond the Blue Horizon. It was featured in the motion picture Rain Man. How much of it was played in Rain Man?
It all depends on what cutting you see of the movie.
It's like a director's cut.
A lot of it was played in the original cut.
Right.
And, of course, how they start editing things down. But it was in five other movies.
Really? I didn't know
yes.
that.
Yes, Home of Our Own by Kathy Bates. She has a big scene where she hears it on the radio. She says, oh, this is my favorite record. I mean, it has been, it lasts forever because people
yeah.
love this record. And I think it gets more response than anything I've ever recorded.
Wow.
Over the years, this thing has just lasted. I don't know how people find it, because when the record came out, the record label sort of went out of business, and it was just reported all around the country as the most interesting and most responsive they've ever had to a record.
Right.
And it just lives on, and I just feel great about it. It's very inspiring.
It has a very unique beginning, where initially we could hardly hear you.
On purpose.
On purpose.
And
it was
fade in and fade out.
This is Ronnie Allen saying thank you so very much for taking the time to do this, and I want to wish you continued health, happiness, and success in whatever you do.
Thank you very much, Ron.
And we're going to close with this great recording. This is Beyond the Blue Horizon, Lou Christie.
We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.